Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Philip Lance, and I'm a host of the Psychoanalysis channel. Today, I'm interviewing neuropsychoanalyst Mark Solms about his book, The Hidden Spring, A Journey to the Source of Consciousness, published by Norton in 2021. My longtime listeners may remember that I interviewed Mark about 5 years ago after the publication of his 2015 book, The Feeling Brain. Since then, he has become even more famous in the world of psychoanalysis and neuroscience, so it's a pleasure to have him on the show again. Here's his short bio from the back cover of the book. Mark Solms discovered the forebrain mechanisms of dreaming. He is director of neuropsychology, Neuroscience Institute at the University of Cape Town, South Africa, where he lives. He is also honorary lecturer in neurosurgery, Royal London Hospital School of Medicine, and honorary fellow, American College of Psychiatrists. In the world of psychoanalysis, Mark is known for, among other things, his argument that Freud was right about some things, some of the things that 20th century neuroscience got wrong. In the world of philosophy, he's known for going a long way towards solving what's known as the hard problem of consciousness. Mark is the founder of a discipline called neuropsychoanalysis, a discipline that integrates neuroscience with psychoanalysis in a way that allows each of these two disciplines to illuminate the other. I'm imagining that some of our listeners may be having a skeptical response right now, doubting that brain science and psychoanalysis have anything to teach each other. But more on that later in the episode. In the first part of this interview, I'm going to ask Mark to outline the basic features of neuropsychoanalysis, and then we'll look more specifically at this latest of his books, The Hidden Spring, to learn more about where it fits into his oeuvre and what it contributes to the field. So welcome to the show again, Mark.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
And let's just begin with maybe you telling us, what's the big idea you've contributed? Maybe there's a bunch of big ideas, but give us the biggest one. And I'm guessing that it might be something about how consciousness subsists in the inner, older portions of the brain where affective states reside. And unconsciousness resides in the cortex, the newer, outer layer of the brain, which is kind of the opposite of how people often think about it. Am I on the right track there?
Yes. So what you've just said is basically correct. I'll fill in a few details. But you're asking about my contributions there. I think you're asking about my contributions to neuroscience. And my work in that field began with a study of the brain mechanisms of dreaming. I started working in that area in the 1980s, but my first publications in that area came out in the mid-1990s. And the main thing that I found at that time was that dreams are generated by different brain mechanisms from those that generate REM sleep. And the specific mechanism for dreaming is a circuit, or the driving circuit for dreaming, arises in the brain stem and projects forwards into the frontal lobes. And it's the chemical, the neuromodulator that mediates it is dopamine. Now, why that was important from a psychoanalytic point of view, you say that I showed that neuroscientists had made some errors that Freud had got some things right that we in neuroscience had got wrong, and that was certainly an example of that, because the dopamine circuit that I found generates dreams as opposed to REM sleep is about as close as you can get to a neurological equivalent of what Freud called libidinal drive. That it's called the brain reward system, or it's called the seeking system. It's the major motivational system of the mammal brain, and that's what drives dreams. So dreams are driven and motivated. You know, that was news, and that's what made me interested, because that circuit starts in the brain stem. It's one of they're a collection of nuclei in the brain stem which are called the reticular activating system. And so this circuit that drives dreams has its origin in the reticular activating system of the brain stem. And when I say it drives dreams, what I mean is it drives a state of consciousness that intrudes into the unconsciousness of sleep. I mean, the most striking feature of dreaming is that although you're asleep, you're conscious. So that made me interested in the role of those nuclei in generating consciousness. And the fact that the consciousness, the quality of consciousness that drives dreams is this seeking, this positive reward-seeking, pleasure-seeking drive, also made me interested in the role of those brainstem nuclei in drive, you know, in motivation and in affect, because these are felt states of consciousness. That led me to team up with a brilliant neuroscientist who sadly died a few years ago, named Jaak Panksepp. He was doing the most interesting work at that time. Well, I think actually he was doing the most interesting work of all time on how these deep brainstem mechanisms, ancient primitive structures, which we share with all vertebrates, you know, how these circuits are the source of consciousness, number one, as opposed to the cortex, that it's these primitive structures. Number two, that they are also imbued with these affective qualities that I was talking about earlier. So it was a revolution. I have to say that revolution is not mine to claim. It's much more Jaak Panksepp's. I teamed up with him because of what I had found in relation to dreaming. I teamed up with him in his work on the role of these brainstem nuclei in generating consciousness and affect, suggesting that consciousness came from within, from below, that it was a very basic function, and that it was intimately bound up with affect. That in turn led us to have to doubt the traditional views of the role of cortex in consciousness. The cortex is not intrinsically conscious. The cortex is only conscious to the extent that it is activated by the reticular activating system. So its consciousness is derived from those primitive affective instinctual mechanisms at the core of the brain. So yes, as you said in your question, that entailed a reversal of the traditional view that consciousness was associated with the highest functions of the cortex, and that these brainstem structures were automatized reflexes and, you know, nothing of any great interest from a psychological point of view. But I have to just add one further point, which is that the cortex, the representational or cognitive mechanisms of the cortex are, of course, capable of consciousness when they are activated from below. Then our cognitive processes, including our perceptual processes and our thought processes, they become conscious. But there are other forebrain structures between the brainstem and the cortex, which we call subcortical ganglia, the most important ones of which are the basal ganglia and the amygdala, but also the cerebellum. These are also representational structures. They're not dry. They're not arousal structures. They are responsible for varieties of memory and varieties of cognition. And those structures are utterly unconscious. So the cortex can be rendered conscious by the brainstem, and thereby its cognitive processes can become conscious. That's equivalent to what Freud called pre-conscious processes. In other words, they're descriptively unconscious, but they can be rendered conscious. Whereas the basal ganglia and amygdala and cerebellum, these subcortical forebrain structures, they are responsible also for memory and the cognitions derived from memory, but those cognitions remain utterly unconscious. They are therefore more the equivalent of what Freud called the unconscious as opposed to the preconscious. So I just didn't want to leave our viewers or listeners with the impression that the cortex is utterly unconscious. The cortex is capable of consciousness to the extent that it's activated by the brainstem, but the subcortical memory systems are forever unconscious. And this is of great interest, of course, to psychoanalysts.
Okay. And by the way, if I'm yelling, I hope our listeners don't feel like I'm shouting at them, but we're having a little technical volume issue, so I'm speaking very loudly. All right, well, let's then go back to this libidinal drive that Freud originally theorized that was motivating the dream images. So for those of our listeners who are clinicians who might be hearing dreams from their clients, this idea would imply that those dreams could be interpreted based upon an idea that they're motivated by some libidinal seeking underlying drive. And so I guess my question, is neuropsychoanalysis a drive theory? There's some forms of schools of psychoanalysis that don't emphasize the drive as much. But so talk to us about drives in psychoanalysis.
Sure, gladly. First of all, let me just go back to what you said about dreams. Although the seeking drive, the one that is most similar to what Freud called the libidinal drive, although that is the crucial system, among these different arousal systems, it's the crucial one because damage to that system obliterates dreaming. If that system is dysfunctional, then no dreams happen. So it's absolutely pivotal. But if you image the dreaming brain, you see that all of these different drive systems, not only that one, this what we call the seeking system, all of them are activated during dreaming sleep. So, I mean, it really is quite remarkable considering that the person is asleep, you know, how all these motivational systems are switched on really full blast. So the others are also implicated in dreams. It's just that this one is the crucial one. And the way that we think about that, if you'll forgive my French, you know, as they say, when you go out into the world expecting that all of your desires are going to be met, and then shit happens. So we have other motivational systems for dealing with, you know, the disappointments. So there are fear drives, There are anger, or what we call rage drives. There are separation distress drives. And then there are other ones which are happier, you know, like there's a drive to play, which is an astonishing discovery. There's a drive to care, a nurturing drive. And then, of course, there's our old favorite, the sexual drive. So what I've just said is that all of these drive systems are involved in dreaming. You have a wish. It doesn't mean it's going to pan out the way that you want it to, because, you know, all sorts of other things exist other than what you want. And in saying that, I'm taking the opportunity to enumerate the emotional drives that we've discovered in affective neuroscience and in neuropsychoanalysis. And the evidence for the existence of these drives is overwhelming. Now, you say that many psychoanalytic schools have moved away from drive theory. And it's not hard to understand why. It's because everybody lost confidence in them. Not everybody, but a good many psychoanalysts and people who work psychoanalytically lost confidence in Freudian drive theory. It seemed too reductionist and too biological and too simple to account for the rich complexity of what happens what we see in the consulting room and what happens in our lives. So I need to point out that the rejection of Freudian drive theory needn't imply a rejection of drive theory in general, because in fact, as long as the mind is embodied, and after all, what else can it be? You know, we are, after all, a species of animal. This is one of the foundational starting points of psychoanalysis, is that we are embodied. I mean, that we are whatever else we are, uniquely human. Nevertheless, human beings are a species of animal. You just have to look at the fact that we need to eat, sleep, drink, etc. You know, we need to, otherwise we die. We are embodied creatures. And so, you know, the idea that there are drives, whether the ones that Freud identified are correct or not, is a very different matter from the question as to, are there drives? Freud's definition of drives was that they are measures of the demand made upon the mind for work by virtue of the connection between the mind and the body. In other words, because the mind is embodied, it's driven by our biological constitution. That doesn't mean the totality of the mind is its drives, but you know, it's kind of like, if you'll forgive the pun, a no-brainer, that there must be drives. So what we've found in the decades since Freud's pioneering work, using methods that Freud could barely have dreamt of having access to, is that, of course, there are drives in the human brain. And I'm only mentioning the emotional drives when I list the seven that I did a moment ago. But they're very different from how Freud conceptualized them. First of all, because they're not two, they're seven. So, you know, that's news. And secondly, because they are intrinsically object relational. And that's a very important point in terms of your remark about many schools of psychoanalysis having moved away from drive theory. Freud's view was that drives were these kind of blind, objectless forces. Objectless was literally the term that he used for them. But if you think back to what I just said about the seven drives, the seven emotional drives, I described, for example, a drive to play, that implies a certain kind of object relationship. You know, you can't play without a playmate. There's a drive to attach, which I mentioned under the heading of separation distress. It implies a certain kind of object, an attachment object. You can't have a drive to attach without an object of a specific kind, namely a caregiving object. I spoke of a nurturant drive, which implies a dependent, vulnerable little object that you're looking after, and so on. I won't go through all seven. Well, let me just say, fear implies a persecutory object, rage, a frustrating obstacle of an object. You know, so these are intrinsically, inherently object relational drives. And so I think that the the great schism in the major traditions over the 20th century in psychoanalysis between drive theorists and object relational theorists is bridged by the discovery that the real drives at work in the human brain and mind are intrinsically object related. They carry within themselves something along the lines of what Bion called a preconception of an object, of a certain kind of object. Then you find that category of object in the actual world that you're born into, like a caregiving object or a persecuting object or a frustrating object and so on. But these are a priori categories of object relationship that we human beings, by dint of being human beings, are born to expect. And what we mean by a drive is that there are these viable bounds that we have to stay in, like I need to have my caregiver nearby. I need to not be under attack. I need to not have frustrating obstacles impeding me from reaching the other, for satisfying my other needs and so on. So the concept here, the core concept, is homeostasis. There's that we need to be within those viable ranges, like, you know, not under attack. These are built upon basic bodily processes, like I need to be in a certain temperature range, I need a certain amount of oxygen, I need a certain blood pressure. Deviations from those viable states are what we call drives. In other words, I'm not where I need to be. And that's, to paraphrase Freud again, that's the measure of the demand for work. We now have to do something to get back into our viable bounds. And that is unpleasurable feeling and pleasurable feeling. So that's how we conceptualize drive now. I can put it in much more sort of user-friendly terms and just say we have basic emotional needs, just like we have basic bodily needs. And if those needs are not being met, we feel an unpleasant, you know, pressure of a particular quality. And we are strongly motivated to get rid of those bad feelings. And there are certain kinds of things we have to do. That's demands for work, you know, in reality. So there we have the famous old pleasure principle and the reality principle. There are things we have to do in the world in order to satisfy our emotional needs. So, yeah, we have a drive theory in neuropsychoanalysis built on a lot of very, very good evidence accumulated over decades. But I have to supplement my answer there, Philip, by pointing out that neuropsychoanalysis isn't only a drive theory. You know, we also have the other important discoveries that we've made and that we have drawn upon, because not all of the discoveries in neuropsychoanalysis were made by us ourselves. You know, as I said earlier, Panksepp's work was fundamentally important. Likewise, the work of these days as somebody named Carl Friston, who's working more at the cognitive end of things. You know, we've made all sorts of interesting observations drawing upon those developments in cognitive neuroscience as opposed to affective neuroscience, and applying them to the psychoanalytic situation and developing them therefore in specifically neuropsychoanalytical ways. And here I'm referring to the drives have to do with those brain stem structures I mentioned earlier. The cognitive side of things is more the forebrain end. And I said that there are these cortical structures and then these subcortical structures, all of which subserve what Freud would have called memory systems. You must remember Freud's topographical model, that picket fence thing that we first saw in the chapter 7 of the Interpretation of Dreams. That topographical model is a model of the different memory systems of the human mental instrument or mental apparatus, as Freud called it. And we've learned a whole lot of new things about how those memory systems work. As I said a moment ago, the cortical ones are equivalent to what Freud called preconscious, The subcortical ones are equivalent to what Freud called unconscious, but those unconscious memory systems, please note the plural, you know, there's not just one of them. The two most important for clinical psychoanalysis are what are called the procedural memory systems and the emotional memory systems. And equally important is that they are not only unconscious, but unconscious forevermore. They cannot be rendered conscious by dint of the nature of the representations that we're talking about. They are just response patterns. They can only be enacted. They can never be thought. So that's important. So that has all sorts of implications for psychoanalysis. Then the preconscious ones, the cortical ones, you know, again, we divide them into subsystems. These can be rendered conscious. We call them the episodic and the semantic memory systems. And what we've learned about how all of these memory systems work, I'm just sort of alluding to it. I'm not explicating it. Is all of it of great interest. And one last point I want to make in that in that area is that we think under the influence of Carl Friston's work, we think of these memory systems as prediction systems. So although memories are about the past, they are for the future. Memory, you know, the whole point of learning from experience is to change what you do in future to better predict. On the basis of past experience, I predict that the world works like this. And so this is a fundamentally important notion, that memory systems are really essentially prediction systems. And I hope you can see the immediate connection to psychoanalysis, the whole idea of wish and transference, you know, that we project onto the present the experiences from our past, that we expect to find in the present what we found in the past. So all of this stuff is of great relevance for psychoanalysis, not only the drive theory, also these revisions of our understanding of what would have been called topographical theory in the old days, or structural theory.
Yeah, you just triggered my memory of something that happened in a session yesterday that really, I think I stumbled on this idea about memories about the past, but it's about predicting the future. With a client who was talking about his anxiety and why does he have it? And I thought we could see by his history, he had good reason to have learned to be very anxious about the world. And things were still difficult for him with regard to his mother and his father. So there's good reason that he would predict things are going to continue to be dangerous for him. But anyway, I'd rather have you tell me a clinical application. How is this used in the clinic, these ideas?
Well, so depending on how you date it, neuropsychoanalysis began officially in 1999. We started the journal named Neuropsychoanalysis, and the society, the International Neuropsychoanalysis Society, a year later. Of course, that was preceded by years of work. My own first publication that was explicitly about the relationship between psychoanalysis and neuroscience was 1986. So you know, for a long time, we were just doing groundwork, basic science, trying to translate neuroscientific knowledge into psychoanalytic terms and vice versa, psychoanalytic knowledge into neuroscientific terms. And we had to do all of that before we could get to the application of this basic theoretical work to our clinical practice. And it was very frustrating for many of my psychoanalytic colleagues, you know, they were saying, well, that's all very interesting, Mark, you know, but what does it tell us about what we should be doing? And so happily, I can say, over the last, I can date it pretty precisely, really, over the last 10 years, because it was at our Neuropsychoanalysis Congress in Berlin in 2012 that the first breakthroughs, it first became obvious that we were learning things which really did have implications for clinical practice. So you ask me, you know, what sort of implications it has. Well, to begin with, what I said earlier about there being seven emotional drives. And if people don't like the word drive, let me repeat what I said earlier. There are seven basic emotional needs of the human being. That means that each and every one of us needs to satisfy the drive to play, the drive to be cared for, the drive to be safe, the drive to nurture, odd as it may seem. We actually need to look after little vulnerable ones, and so on. And so to know that these are the basic emotional needs of our patients, and also remember what I said about their role in consciousness, that the fundamental mechanisms of what we are conscious of are feeling mechanisms. And then you start to see, okay, so, you know, what drives the life of the mind is how we feel, which is to say something pretty bloody obvious, but to say it now on the basis of really good scientific evidence that what drives what we do is how we feel, good and bad feelings of various kinds. And knowing what the kinds of different emotional needs are enables us to recognize the quality of our patient's suffering, which is conscious. Our patients suffer mainly from feelings, and they come to us. Usually their presenting complaints are, you know, I feel like this, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, I'm angry. And they want to not feel like this. These are varieties of unpleasure, again, to use the old-fashioned terms. So we believe it's very, we in neuropsychoanalysis, we foreground in our evaluation, our first sessions with our patients, we foreground what is the patient feeling, what is the actual nature of the emotional trouble that they're bringing to us doctors of feelings, and recognizing which of these basic emotional needs is not being met is recognizable through the fundamental the affect of quality. Of the patient's suffering, which is, let us not forget, what brings patients to treatment. So recognizing what that is, not only does it put us on the same page as the patient from the get-go, in other words, that's a good basis for a therapeutic alliance, that we both understand that what we're trying to do is to help the patient with this suffering, which has this particular quality. But it tells us which of their emotional needs is not being met, which immediately, and of course, it doesn't mean it's only one, but usually there's something which stands out against the background of all the other things. And so this is our kind of basic point of orientation. So this is the problem. It's a feeling of this kind that's derailing this patient's life, which means there's this emotional need is not being met. And then that leads us to the question as to what is unconscious. In other words, how is the patient going about meeting this need because it's clearly not working for them? And remember what I said earlier about our cognitive, our predictive systems being based on early experience. And there you see all the phenomena of transference and whatnot, you know, what the patient is enacting, what the patient is repeating. But it enables us to just see it a little bit more clearly in relation to this nosology or taxonomy of the drives. So the first thing that we say to clinical, to our colleagues is, it's very important to identify what the nature of the patient's suffering is. And then secondly, to ask the question, okay, looking at the transference and the history, trying to infer, to reconstruct, well, how does this patient go about meeting this need? And why do they go about meeting this need in that way? The fundamental task, then, a clinical task, becomes making the patient aware through transference interpretation, in fact, but slightly differently understood, I would say more broadly understood, because transference doesn't only happen to the analyst. The patient doesn't only transfer onto us. They transfer onto their current object relationships. These predictions derive from their primary object relationships. And so looking at the enactment of transference in this broad way, we try to bring to the patient's attention how they are going about meeting this need and problematizing it. It's become automatized. It's become unconscious. Remember what I said about those different memory systems. These are unconscious memory systems. The patient cannot remember the solutions they came to life's problems in childhood, but they enact those solutions. The predictions are enacted. It's the only way they can be remembered. And we draw the patient's attention to the enactments, to what they're doing. And in this way, if I can sort of formalize it in a way that, of course, we don't actually speak to our patients, but to say, can you see you doing this thing over and again? Can you see it's meant to satisfy this need? This is why you're doing it. Number three, can you see it's not satisfying that need? It's not working. And fourthly, that's why you're suffering from this feeling. In other words, to make the patient aware through drawing attention to the transference in the broad sense, to problematize how they're going about meeting this particular emotional need. You invariably find when you reconstruct where it came from that there are conflicts between the different emotional needs. So to sort of summarize, the contributions that we're making to clinical work is to understand the importance of these drives and the classification of those drives, how they are directly expressed in the feeling lives of our patients. It helps us to understand what feelings mean in a new, slightly new way. It's not a radical revolution in psychoanalysis. We're building upon what we learned, you know, over the 100 years before neuropsychoanalysis. We're just adding a new layer to it. And then the understanding of how these memory systems work, that the unconscious is fundamentally a prediction system, that the predictions get enacted, they can't be thought, but what the enactments themselves can be thought about, showing the present in behaviors thoughts. And in this way, rendering conscious once more something which has become automatized, and thereby giving the patient choice to rethink now with their new circumstances, to free them from the compulsion, the repetition compulsion of having to do this thing. So you can see in everything I'm saying, it's pretty standard psychoanalytical stuff with little tweaks here and there to help us to see just a little bit more clearly what's going on. And God knows the life of the mind is a complicated enough thing. And so any help that we can get, we gratefully accept.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
When, you know, psychotherapists are famous for asking this question, how do you feel about that? And I think, and sometimes I myself ask this question, it feels very useful. And I think I would have in the past, before I read your book, have thought, well, it's because people aren't always conscious of their feelings. But your book argues people are conscious by definition of their feelings. So why do we ask them to, why do we ask them what they're feeling if everybody's conscious of it?
Well, feelings, as the word implies, are felt. In other words, there's no such thing as a feeling that you don't feel. So yes, feelings are conscious. When we speak about them being unconscious, what we really mean is we don't know where it comes from. You know, so a patient feels something, but they don't understand why. They don't want to feel like this. It seems irrational to them that they should have such intense feelings about things. And so the unconscious part is what causes the feeling. Where did it come from? Why? What explains the feeling? And so that's, again, as I said earlier, just a slightly different way of understanding. I think that the whole of neuropsychoanalysis really just helps us to think a little bit more clearly and to see a little bit more clearly what's going on. It sort of brings our theory up to speed with what we actually do. I think that we have the baggage of a whole lot of theories that kind of bequeathed to us by the history of our discipline rather than by virtue of actually explaining what's going on. So that's an excellent example. You know, we think of the unconscious and the conscious in kind of the wrong way around. And once you explain to colleagues, you know, well, hang on a minute, the patient feels that's their suffering. That's why they're coming to us. That's not unconscious. What's unconscious is the predictions. In other words, what are they doing that they predict will meet this need? Because clearly it's not working because that need's not being met. And where do those predictions come from? Well, they come from the developmental history, of our patients. And so, yeah, that's exactly how it works.
Okay, so we have a wide variety of listeners to new books in psychoanalysis. And some of those listeners come from a very academic context, oftentimes in the humanities rather than the natural sciences. And some of those listeners conceive of psychoanalysis as a critical project, critical in the sense of political, radical, revolutionary, and disruptive, rather than medicinal or medical. And so those, I could imagine some of those listeners are, reacting that what you're doing is returning psychoanalysis to these banal foundations of Western science, the experimental method and all that, rather than to the critical work of exposing the scientific ideologies that blind us to emancipatory possibilities. So what would you say to those critics? And have you encountered this objection?
Oh yes, I encounter it all the time. Happily, that sort of concern or anxiety about what we're up to in neuropsychoanalysis is diminishing. As I said earlier, we've been at it now for three or more decades. I face much less resistance than I did. But what you raise is a very important topic. I want to answer it comprehensively, but I worry I'll get lost in the details. So let me just say up front, first of all, that neuropsychoanalysis does not seek to take anything away from psychoanalysis. It seeks to add something. So, it's not... everything that psychoanalysis has been historically, everything that we've gained and learnt about the life of the mind in psychoanalysis is the psychoanalysis part of neuropsychoanalysis. We then add to that what we can also learn from this other point of view. When I say from this other point of view, The unique thing about the mind is that it has dual aspects. I'm a dual aspect monist, as indeed was Freud. In other words, when Freud said that consciousness has two perceptual surfaces, one faces outwards and registers objects, the other faces inwards and registers our subjectivity. These are two different perspectives upon one and the same thing. When I wake up in the morning and feel myself to be alive, and thank God for that, that's my mind, my subjective being of Mark Solms. And then when I stagger over to the bathroom and look in the mirror, I see a body. That's also me. It's also Mark Solms. They're not two of us. You know, these are two different perspectives upon the same thing. And what unites these two different perceptual surfaces, as Freud said, is the underlying functional organization of the mental apparatus, as Freud called it. You know, so what we're doing is metapsychology. In other words, inferring what lies behind subjective experience, and then adding to it, and what lies behind the objective perspective on the very same thing, and adding the two perspectives to each other. So it's not taking away the subjective perspective. It's saying, well, what can we also learn from the objective point of view on the very same thing? And it is the very same thing. As I say, when I look at my bodily form in the mirror, it's me. You know, it's the same me as is my subjective mental life that I free associate from when I'm lying on a couch. These are just two points of view on one and the same part of reality. So we're adding an additional point of view. We're not taking away the first one. Remember, I said I'm going to give you a long answer to this. I'm sorry, but I just have to tell our listeners or viewers where I started from. I was first and foremost a neuroscientist, and I was frustrated by, when I say a neuroscientist, I was in particular a neuropsychologist. In other words, I was studying and practicing that branch of neuroscience which is devoted to the study of the relationship between brain and mind. And I was terribly disappointed and frustrated by how little mind there was in neuroscience. It just the mind that my professors taught me about in the 70s and 80s, you know, was a information processing device. There was no what it is like to be somebody experiencing a memory, or a feeling. Or a fantasy or a dream. And it was all just this desiccated mechanistic cognitive machinery. And I thought, to quote my late friend Oliver Sacks, who said in 1984, it's when I first contacted him and it was the beginning of our friendship, he said, neuropsychology is admirable, but it excludes the psyche. You know, neuropsychology excludes the psyche. And I thought, right on, that's correct. And so that was why I turned to psychoanalysis to try to rectify mental life into neuropsychology. So it's not that I was a psychoanalyst who was looking to neuroscience to try to make us more scientific and make us more objective and, you know, reduce us to an experimental discipline. It was exactly the opposite, that I was seeking to bring into neuroscience everything that psychoanalysis had to offer. And I think it's important that people understand that. I'm somebody who greatly values what can be learnt from the subjective point of view. There are things that you can never see with your eyes, not least of them feelings. You know, you'll never see a feeling. It's not a thing. It's not an object. It's a subjective state of being. And so if you don't take that perspective on the brain, add the psychoanalytic point of view, you will never understand how this part of nature works. Because, you know, we all know that we're driven by subjective states, things like feelings that you cannot see. And so, you know, that's been my project. My project has, but once you build that bridge between psychoanalysis and neuroscience, it's a two-way bridge. God knows, certainly Freud was greatly looking forward to the day when it would be possible to study the mental apparatus also from a biological point of view. And, you know, it's hard. It's the psychoanalytic, it's very hard to understand just one session, let alone, you know, one whole person in their totality, let alone, you know, the whole of the human mind, you know, if just using the method of free association. We need all the help we can get. And there are real contributions but everything I have drawn upon from my neuroscientific knowledge and colleagues' knowledge and brought to bear on psychoanalytical problems, it's always been only a matter of, let's try this out. Let's see, does this add something? Does this help us to see more and better? Does it enable us to see something we otherwise might not have seen and thereby do something we might otherwise not have done? So the final test of all of these theoretical innovations derived from neuroscience is in the clinical situation. It's, you know, the clinical situation remains the final court of appeal for psychoanalysis. That's where we discern. And from there, we make our contributions back to neuroscience too, and have been, you know, now for years. So this is not a reductionist project. When I say it's a dual aspect monism, it means everything that we can learn and have learned over more than 100 years of psychoanalysis about the fundamental workings of the mind, that we're adding to that an additional perspective and contributing that perspective to enrich the objective perspective, to ameliorate what can't be seen, to fill in the gaps in the neuroscientific conception of the mind, and then, you know, it works both ways. Freud, for those people who think that psychoanalysis is fundamentally antithetical to science, I must remind them that Freud was a neuroscientist and then a neurologist, and that he described psychoanalysis from the beginning to the end as a natural science. In fact, toward the end of his life, in one place, he actually said, "What else could it be?" So he was aspiring to bring subjectivity into natural science, to bring this part of nature, in other words, lived experience and what lies behind it, to bring it into to integrate it with, because God knows it exists. You know, experience exists, subjectivity exists. Freud was trying to incorporate that into science. Now, if you do that, it means you're integrating everything that we've learned from the subjective to just use one word for it, from the humanist perspective, the Geisteswissenschaften, as it's called in German. It brings all of that into conjunction with science and vice versa. So Freud applied what we learned in the what he termed the natural science of psychoanalysis. He then applied this to the study of religion and the study of mythology and the study of groups and social formations and literature and art and so on. You know, it's a wonderful thing that we can have a science of the mind which is both able to speak to and draw upon the humanities, and also speak to and draw upon the brain sciences. I don't see why it has to be one or the other. I don't see a fundamental antagonism between the two at all. As I said in the beginning of my long answer to your question, happily, you know, the International Neuropsychoanalysis Society now has more than 1,000 members. We're also, I'm not sure how many psychoanalysts and psychotherapists realize how we are also breaking down barriers in the other direction. In other words, making people who are so prejudiced scientists who have historically been so prejudiced against psychoanalysis by having a language, a kind of a Rosetta Stone that translates between the one language and the other, being able to explain to them in words they can understand, but this is what we believe, this is what we're doing. And they say, well, why didn't you say so? That makes sense. You know? So I think it's also important in a environment in which it's a big mistake for psychoanalytically minded people to sequester themselves from the scientific Weltanschauung and say we don't believe in evidence, we don't care about science, science is the enemy. You know, that's like saying the reality principle is the enemy. We're just going to stake our claim on the pleasure principle alone. There's a very slippery slope that. Anyway, I've said enough.
Okay. You know, I did a really woefully inadequate job of introducing you, but I feel a need to kind of let people know about your stellar credentials, both on the psychoanalytic side and the neuroscience side. If I remember right, you're the general editor of the revised translation of the complete works of Sigmund Freud. Credentials on the neuroscience side, I don't know. In my mind, you're probably one of the top 10 public neuroscientists in the world. I don't know what you might point to. But let me ask a double-barreled question here, because I want to begin wrapping up this interview. So you could answer that. But let's talk about this book, The Hidden Spring, because a lot of what we've covered in this interview really is similar ground to what we talked about 5 years ago when we talked about your book, The Feeling Brain. What does this book do new? I want to tell listeners it is more technical, I think, than The Feeling Brain in terms of the wet tissue sort of data we get into. But what does it add to your project?
Well, thanks. When you say that I am an eminent neuroscientist, I want to make clear that what sets me apart from my neuroscientific colleagues, in other words, to the extent that I have acquired prominence, it is precisely because I have turned to psychoanalysis, you know, and drawn upon the psychoanalytic tradition. It's injected something utterly new into neuroscience, and that's thanks to psychoanalysis. You know, that's the wellspring upon which I have drawn since the 1980s, and I'm very grateful and very lucky to have taken that path. Now, against that background, I can answer your question. This book, The Hidden Spring, is not addressed primarily at a psychoanalytical audience. It's addressed primarily at a scientific audience, a general scientific audience. I would say probably I thought that I was it would be comprehensible to a wider general audience than it is, because it is a difficult book. That is because it tackles the hardest problem that there is in contemporary science as a whole, let alone neuroscience, you know, which is the so-called hard problem of consciousness. So the book is about, fundamentally, it's about trying to tackle at the roots this hard problem of consciousness, but it does so by drawing upon psychoanalytic ideas. So it's me. So I'm taking from everything I've learned through my God, what is it now? 35 years of involvement with psychoanalysis. And it's kind of the culmination of all of that integrative work that I've done, but not speaking to psychoanalysis here. I'm speaking more to the other side, as it were, and to people who think fundamentally neuroscientifically, which I have to say also is the kind of the more. The majority of mental scientists these days are not psychoanalysts. The majority of mental scientists are neuroscientists and cognitive scientists. So I'm speaking to them if I'm speaking to any specialism, but I'm trying also to speak to a general sort of educated audience about how does our understanding of the hard problem change if we recognize the things that we spoke about in this conversation at the outset, namely that we that consciousness is not this very complicated cognitive, self-reflective, uniquely human and linguistic business, that consciousness is just raw feeling at its heart. And if we tackle the hard problem of consciousness from the bottom up, asking, you know, why do we feel? What is the point of feelings? What do they do? How do they change the life of the mind? It casts a very different light on the nature of consciousness and the nature of the problem of consciousness. So that's what the book's about. It is hard, I'm sorry, because it's the hard problem, but I've tried my best to make it as accessible as possible to as wide an audience as possible. But I need to emphasize again, I say so in the book, but, you know, I want to emphasize here that it is fundamentally drawing upon psychoanalytic sources of knowledge and ways of thinking. And I think that to the extent that I've made any progress in solving that problem, it's been because I've taken that approach.
Yeah, it's 300 pages. I would just, if you read it slowly, though, it is very accessible. You know, it's difficult, especially for those of us who don't wander into these waters often, but like so much of your writing and speaking, there's a real clarity to it. And if you patiently work your way through it, a very profound ideas and argument that are also extremely relevant. Just today in the New York Times, I read a story about artificial intelligence and people who are beginning to make claims that there's these new robots, artificially intelligent robots, that are sentient or conscious. And I think the agreement is no, they're not. But in your final chapter, which really beautifully lyrically written almost, you describe a project that you believe may be possible to build a machine that's not just intelligent, but that feels and therefore is conscious. And what are the challenges with that, and including the ethical challenges? It's a fascinating read, and I would encourage people who pick up the book to stay to it through the end, because there's some really extremely relevant current things you're wrestling with there.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you emphasized the ethical challenges. I tried very hard to make clear in that chapter, you know, it's really a huge ethical challenge in all sorts of ways, this quest to engineer an artificial consciousness. But I was never interested in artificial intelligence. I always thought it was ludicrous that these people are speaking about artificial minds. You know, they're talking about something that's got nothing to do with the mind, the lived life of the mind. And now over the last few years, you know, I find myself deep. I'm working very closely with physicists and applied mathematicians and roboticists and computational neuroscientists. As you said, what we're trying to do is not to engineer an artificial intelligence so much as an artificial form of feeling. In other words, an artificial system that functions in the way that I described earlier about drives. It basically, it's a system which the basic design feature of which is that what wants to continue to exist. It wants to continue to be. And so there are certain needs like energy supply and so on that it has, if it is going to continue to exist, and it has to work to meet those needs. And so that the idea that basically that homeostatic mechanism, which is very simple, certainly very simple compared to our cortical cognitive processes, that sort of mechanism surely is engineerable. The crucial questions there, apart from the ethical ones, are what justifies one to take the point of view of an artificial intelligence? What justifies you to even begin to speak of how are things from the point of view of this system? And there's a lot that I could say about, you know, what the prerequisites are to even speak about the system's point of view. And then the other really big question is, how do you go about determining whether there is something it is like to be the system? In other words, does it feel like something to be such a system? Because of the problem of other minds, you can never observe a subjective state objectively. And so that's another really complicated methodological and epistemological problem that we're grappling with. But it's fascinating. It's fantastically interesting.
Thank you very much for taking your time to share your work with us. Really appreciate that.
Great. Thank you. And good to see you again after five. I think it might even have been 6 years, but good to see you again. Thank you for your interest.
Just to remind listeners, we've been speaking with Dr. Mark Solms here at New Books in Psychoanalysis. And we're talking today, especially his book, The Hidden Spring, A Journey to the Source of Consciousness. And if you have any questions about the show, please feel free to contact me, philipjlance@gmail.com. Have a good afternoon.